So I get this text from Judith yesterday. I think I might have been driving to the airport, asking me for my title. And I was like, I'm driving. I'm like, learning and marketing during the transition to adulthood. And she's like, it can't be the title of your RRTC. And Leslie says it should really reflect something about the research. And so she's like, can you make it on? And then there's a whole bunch of bullets coming up, and I can't read them. I'm driving to the airport. It's like, I don't know what she's saying, but I'm thinking about what I've got in the presentation. How about infusing youth voice in research and moving the goal from employment to careers? And what she writes back is, wow. And I'm thinking, I was thinking that was kind of standard, but now I got to understand the wow. Because this is what we do, and maybe it's wow, that'd be cool. I think what we do is I love what we do. I'm very excited about it, and I'm looking forward to sharing our work with all of you. But I want to start off by acknowledging, we've been talking about the recovery field, and as everybody, and we have more people to come, have come up and spoken, I've realized personally for me and for our RRTC how much our lives have been touched by the other RRTCs before we even became an RRTC. So I did my clinical psychology internship at the RRTC at Florida Mental Health Institute back in, so I started there. Krista Kutesh, who was one of the deputy directors there when we went to apply for an RRTC, was extremely helpful in helping us think about what is an RRTC and what does it accomplish. She immediately said, you should talk to Mark Salzer, because he's done an amazing job for his first RRTC. So we are now the newbie. He was the baby, now we're the baby. We're still kind of a baby, although we're getting there. We're maybe in early adolescence. I think we're beyond latency, we'll see. So Mark was really helpful then. Krista was an amazing coach. We also went and talked to Bill Anthony and Marianne Farkas before we proposed to get a sense of, you know, what are these RRTCs about. Marcia Ellison, who's one of our senior faculty members, on our RRTC, came to us from BU. She was on the faculty there. Michelle Mullen, who has joined us most recently in our RRTC, got her some of her training there. It is it's a small and very generous world. And I have to go back to I guess it was after my clinical internship, but back in 1995, so that tells you when the clinical internship was before that. I was asked by SAMHSA to develop a review paper about, it was interesting, transition age youth with mental illness who were homeless and homelessness. It was like this really specific thing. And like, what's the research out there? It's like, there was almost no research in general, never mind on homelessness. But they pulled together experts from a variety of places. And the little bit of research that was out there, Judith was there. And I got to talk to Judith about the work that she was doing here, which I now realize was even kind of early for the RRTCs here. But she basically said, you know, I've been trying to do transition age youth, young adult research, and nobody's really interested and you can't get any funding. And so she wasn't pursuing it very much at that point because it was really hard to do. And I agree with her, it was really hard. There weren't many people who were interested. It was hard to get funding, but eventually it worked out. And so it's like literally our lives have been touched by every single RRTC here who way predated ours or recently predated ours, and it's a very generous community, and I just want to say thank you. And I should say Janet's center, I don't want to leave them out. They were the other kids' center before we both applied for the Transition Aid Youth Centers, and there were many people in her center who I had worked with before who were very generous in helping us think about, while we were actually in some ways competing, we hope we weren't competing too tightly with each other for that first one. So many, many thanks to everybody. All right, I did want to put up our mission. And this is, so the learning and working during the transition to adulthood, RRTC, sits within a bigger center that generally does work in transition age youth with serious mental health conditions. And so I did want to put up our broader mission, which is around rehabilitation recovery, full participation, socially valued roles for transition age youth and young adults. Ages 14 to 30, and I want to put that up in part because the very first RRTC announcement came out to cover those ages. And obviously there's a fair amount of overlap in the young adult age with the young adult RRTCs. And then with the funding of our youth, transition age youth RRTCs, there was no longer funding for child RRTCs on the mental health side. And going down to age 14 also dipped down into childhood some. And obviously, we don't hold anybody else for the wild accountable for the wild things that we're about to say here. It doesn't represent anybody else's views. So I did want to start off by saying that our first RRTC was funded in 2009, so 10 years ago. We are just at the very end of our second one. So for folks that started in 79 or 84, it's like, I'm sitting there going like, I was having a hard time figuring out how to summarize our research. You guys were brilliant in trying to summarize what you did. But I wanted to get people grounded a little bit in what we were building from, because back in 2009, all we had in the way of research related to, and we so at the time, the two RRTCs, it wasn't defined as one was transition to employment, one was community participation. It was just two in transition age youth. And we basically decided that if we could crack the nut that is trying to help young people enter, complete their education and training during the times that people typically complete their education and training and launch stronger adult work lives, we would have made a huge contribution to the field and we could feel good about sort of the scope of what we were doing. So we decided to just carve out that piece. And the field at the time consisted of observational studies of school and work outcomes, primarily of special education students, but there were also some community-based, it was a community-based study and a study from children who were largely in residential treatment settings. So, and all of it was really pretty dated. The findings from that uniformly put up these huge red flags that were like the outcomes were terrible as they moved into young adulthood. Just, you know, very few were completing high school. The high school completion rate from the first NLTS study was like around 50%. It was just abysmally low. Work outcomes were very low. They weren't receiving treatment or supports. There was this cliff that they were falling off as they aged out of children's services. So it was like big red flags. That's all it gave you. And it was services as usual. And then the other two lines of research that existed were really coming out of special education primarily, and they were transition services, because people by law, if they were in special education, got transition supports. And so there was Project Renew, which was by folks up in New Hampshire, that was really geared towards helping kids complete their schooling. And they did talk about work a bit in the next stage of life, but it was a little bit more on getting them through high school and maybe into college. There was Mike Bullis had done a tremendous amount of work on kids who were involved with the justice system, who also, many of them also had mental health and substance abuse challenges or disorders. And then Rusty Clark had taken the system of care framework that really guided the children's system at the time, which is what the Florida Mental Health RRTC had really built their work around and had developmentally modified it to say, what would this look like for transition age youth? The research on these were at best some pre-post, mostly local evaluation. They were not particularly well defined. There weren't fidelity measures for the most part. So they were very early, and it wasn't clear that any of them were really moving forward strongly with research. The TIP model has since gone somewhat forward. And then there was employment research in adults with serious mental illness, in which there were no findings specific to young adults. And that was sort of the field that we stepped into, said, hey, if we can make some progress here, there's lots of progress to be made. Two other things I want to make you aware of. So the reason why we use serious mental health conditions as a term, as you probably, I made a little bit of a point earlier, is in the one of the differences, if you're talking about the transition from childhood to adulthood, one of the things that we know is that you go from a child system to an adult system. And there is not even the same language. It's serious emotional disturbance in the children's system, serious mental illness in the adult system. And when we talked, I've been talking to a variety of systems for numerous years at that point. But when you talk with folks in the adult system, they essentially, the perception was there's a very small fraction of young people who are served in the children's system who go on to develop, I'll tell you, real mental illness. That children who have serious emotional disturbance largely suffer from poor parenting and bad behavior. And I was told that specifically by one of the top scholars in employment research. And it was, I was sort of like, serious mental health conditions, I started using that term in part to say it's serious, both, literally, if you looked at the SAMHSA definitions, they completely lined up except that the functional differences were developmental in children, for children, and appropriate in adults. But developmentally, they were a little, if all you said was achieving or that you had a significant disability in developmentally appropriate role functioning, they would have been exactly identical. But there was this perception that serious mental illness was this very narrow list of diagnoses, and that all these other things were not serious mental illness. And so we also had to deal with that as we started to move into this field, that there wasn't even a common language. And there was a feeling that these young people who had very major challenges in their lives that had to do with their mental health condition weren't seriously mentally ill. So that was kind of the place that we walked into. Oh, and so then the other thing, this is also to understand the framework. One of the reasons that I put in our title, Moving the Goal from Employment to Careers, was that as we were looking at the research at the time, what was made clear to us in our reading of it and talking with various folks, including folks at Dartmouth, that one of the major contributions of IPS was moving the world away from saying adults with mental illness can't work to a place and train type of setting in which you get them into the workplace and then you help solve problems. And if you do that, then they get employment. But if all you do is career development, it was largely an excuse to not actually place them in work. And so there was this perception that career development was bad because all it did was give you an excuse to not move somebody forward into actually being employed. And so that was where it came from historically, but you can see very quickly for young people who are moving from high school into their first launch of their adult work lives, thinking about developing careers is really super important. That is developmentally normative, and that is where we should go. And so we were trying to weave that into our work, in finding ways to have those conversations. Okay, so that's where we started. Since I only have 10 years to talk about, I have to talk about where we started a lot. So our scientific contributions, I think, come from really three major thrusts. One is to infuse all of our work with very genuine involvement of youth with lived experience, youth and young adults, in every aspect of the work that we do, from the development of our research ideas to the conduct of the research to the dissemination of the findings and to the more broad knowledge translation activities. And when you do that, you then also start to look at and emphasize youth voice in services as well. And so our programs and what we've looked at and a lot of our knowledge translation projects have also emphasized the role of peers and the role of youth in the voices of every level of the system. And then it was at the very start that we really started saying, well, we've got to blend school and work. There's not a lot of research out there to guide it, but we knew that this was a stage of life in which anybody they were at least completing their high school education, deciding what they were going to do after high school, and for many that included more education or training, while they were also sometimes also working. So you could just look at the developmental stage and say, we also needed to be launching strong adult work lives by thinking about careers. How do you do that blend so that you have the strongest work life you can have that you want? And that in order to develop, we decided to focus on the development of interventions. So things that could be done that would change the outcomes for this population. And primarily then in order to do that, we pursued three lines of attack, so to speak, which very much sort of paralleled Nidler's stages of research. But the first is a line of discovery studies that identifies patterns in youth and their contexts, including the systems that can inform intervention and policy. The second is policy. And systems studies that really look at what facilitates or hinders the placement of strong interventions and supports that can facilitate the outcomes for this group of young people. And then the third are a set of intervention studies, which is to develop and then test, or if we can test somebody else's, we're happy to not do the development if you want to do it first. So that's basically the kind of research that we've done. So our youth voice piece, follow two strains in what I described about the work that we've done, and I'll say up front that we've done more studies than what I'm presenting, but I wanted to give you sort of two lines to think about, because I think it's probably the strongest stuff that we do. Stuff, science. So we started, and I will say, for us, the bringing in, so youth voice being involved in all layers of the work that we were doing, we didn't want to have just an advisory group. We wanted real partnership, and we wanted young people who were going to come in and do the work of research with us. And we, the folks who were there, so Marsha Ellison had experience from being at BU, but the rest of us really did not have deep experience. And then the experience with young people who are at the beginning of their own work lives, and for many of them, not familiar with the effect of their mental health condition on their work lives, was a steep learning curve for us to figure out. We were very lucky to have John Delman guide us through that early work of figuring out how we were going to do that. And we ended up employing, I think initially 5 or 6 people, and by the end of 6 months, I think we had one person there, because we made all these mistakes. I'm looking at Catherine, because she was there with me at the beginning. She was a young adult then. She's a mature adult now, by our definition. So we had a lot to learn. We learned a tremendous amount, and I will tell you, it is an ongoing process. We still make mistakes. We still have the conversations to figure out how we do this better all the time. It's a moving target. It's a moving, progressing, evolving target. But I wanted to give an example of a line of research that we did very much with young people. So we started off with these young folks that we had hired in 2009 and then in 2010, and we basically had a little bit of a pot of money, and we said, what research would you like to do? And they largely worked with Catherine, and we worked through, like, how do you look at the literature for folks who didn't know that and find a topic that had a gap that there wasn't knowledge about or an interest that you have to say, is there research on this? And they identified an area of research which was college completion. And with investigator support, they reviewed the literature, they ID'd a project, which was essentially based on Mark Salzer's center's data that they had collected from adults who had attended college, asking a variety of questions about their experiences, and the young adults decided they wanted to analyze the differences in the answers between the young adults and the more mature adults that were answering those questions. And so they presented their findings at national conferences. They developed a peer review paper. The conclusions at the end, as we were approaching the end of that first RRTC, largely included that college students with serious mental health conditions really needed better academic supports. Yes, they need access to treatment, but recovery and rehabilitation-wise, supporting them functioning as students in their academics was what they wanted. So we then went on to lead a PAR-based development of a peer coaching academic support model called PASS, Peer Academic Supports for Success. Not too oddly, we conducted it with partners at BU, where we worked with them. And so we started off with qualitative interviews of the experiences and perceptions of students, faculty, counseling center, disability services, staff members. All of these interviews were conducted by young people with lived experience. And they concluded from those qualitative studies that the college students were really struggling to navigate their academic demands of college, that they aren't often accessing any formal campus services, and on-campus services lack the resources to meet their needs. This was conducted at 3 different large universities. 2 of them were public, 1 was private. And from faculty and staff, they had mixed beliefs about the appropriate levels of support for students with serious mental health conditions. We heard repeatedly about not wanting to coddle them. And if and students then struggling to ask for formal accommodations, so they're asking informally, and then faculty were struggling to say, well, why should I give you an extension? I'm not giving everybody an extension. And are we just coddling you? Was a very common finding. That they also faced barriers themselves when communicating with on-campus supports because of privacy, so they couldn't coordinate across different services regarding a student. That's, of course, without the student's permission, so if they were getting that permission, they could do that. But this was their experience, was that they were trying to do this on behalf of the student and the other folks wouldn't give them any information. And that many resources shortages impacted their ability to support students effectively. And we took the findings of this and fused it into the working model that we were starting with, which was a blend of a peer coaching support model that people had developed for students who had autism spectrum disorders at Wright State University in Ohio, with a professional coaching model that had developed at BU for students with serious mental health conditions and infused sort of the blend of that with the input from the qualitative interviews. And we ran a small open trial. From which, and sort of as we did that and then refined it, we were able to develop a very detailed logic model, which then guided our research. So really looking at what were the activities of the past coaches and how did they specifically link to intermediate targets that research suggested should get them better ultimate outcomes. And so, you know, you'll have this if you want it, but for every coach behavior, it is linked to a specific intermediate target down here by number. So build peer rapport with students is linked to 3, which is social support. And so we built this model together from all of that. And we ran an open trial. We hired and trained coaches. We screened and enrolled participants. Everybody received PASS. We implemented PASS, collected data, and then conducted focus groups to fix a lot of things that people didn't like about what we were doing or what was not successful. But even with that, we had, with our tiny sample, we had significant pre-post differences in our intermediate targets of self-determination, self-efficacy, reducing distress, and time management specifically in setting goals and priorities. So we were feeling pretty good that we were actually making a difference. We just needed to be more effective. So essentially, this has led to what we recently found will be funded research starting October 1st, which we're extremely excited about, is a randomized controlled trial of a hybrid efficacy implementation study to roll out the more complete model into universities and evaluate its the randomization, the outcomes, and look at implementation issues. So what came out of that also then was a sharing of knowledge that developed over those years of doing this research that very much have a youth flavor. So youth voice and KT products. NARTEC, I think 2 years ago, really emphasized ways that we can share better. And they were raising this issue of either, you can call them, there are different names for it, but we decided to stick with comics. And apparently, technically, that fits. And so we developed some comics for sharing. This is about accommodations. We've also developed tip sheets. And what I wanted to bring your attention to is the stamp, young adult stamp of approval that we put on our pieces of knowledge translation that have literally been run through not just our own young adults with lived experience, but in Massachusetts we have a statewide youth council that is comprised of young people receiving services from the Department of Mental Health. And they have reviewed these products. They tear them up. They tell us we're all off. Lots of red lines all over it. But then they help us put it back together, and it ends up being very accessible, sometimes accessible to absolutely anybody, but we try to make sure that's relevant and accessible in its language for young people. And then, of course, you have to get into the business of YouTube. As we all know, that's where people look things up. I was going to have this play, but I thought we don't have enough time because we're only supposed to do 20 minutes. But we have had a YouTube show. This is called Comeback TV. Gus is our host, who is a young adult with lived experience. Sometimes he had guests. Sometimes he had guests who had dogs with them. Sometimes his guest was like a little pink stuffed animal. He tried to make it entertaining, but shared a variety of pieces of information that came out of the research or things that we were finding that others were finding that we thought we should share. This one was on outside the box accommodations in college. So that's just kind of giving you a flavor for our infusion of youth voice on one sort of line of research, but we have infused their youth voice in all of the work that we do. So I then want to shift gears and talk about this shifting from employment to careers. So this is our much briefer timeline than anybody else has here. And this is not all the work that we have done, but it's some of the key work that has informed our thinking about shifting from thinking of a goal, only a goal for employment, to thinking about if you have a goal for employment or education, we should be thinking about careers. So one of the first pieces of work that we did was working with some folks who were developers of IPS, actually here in Thresholds, to add a peer coach to it and look at adding supported education to it. We also, so a couple of years after we launched that, Michelle Mullen, who was at Rutgers at the time, proposed and was funded for a development DRIP, to develop this model helping youth on the path to employment. I'll give a little bit more detail, and Michelle can correct me for all the things I'm wrong about later. But that was happening at the same, that was happening just right after we started our work with the folks at IPS. I think part of our rationale was this was the biggest model out there that people were talking about as evidence-based, and can we help them think about how to make this work for 16 to 25-year-olds or 16 to 30-year-olds? So that was sort of our goal with that. Then in 2013, we held our State of the Science meeting. Then we were lucky to be funded again. We kind of pushed IPS towards the high school-aged youth. That's down below. Then if you look up, we also had the CHEER study, which I have the wrong name for. I was checking with Catherine because, like Judith, I also couldn't. It's like, what does that stand for? It's actually not creating. What was it? Collecting histories of education and employment during recovery. That's the R. I only put the R up. I couldn't remember what it was for. So anyway, it's embarrassing to say, but we're being open here. It's a retrospective timeline follow-back study that looked at older young adults, having them recreate their path from school to where they are now. These were all young adults with lived experience who had had some experience of post-secondary schooling, training, or employment to describe, because we realized in the literature there really weren't descriptions of what are some of the paths. So we collected, we conducted that study, and in the meantime, HIPE received a research DRIP, so that is just starting, and then within the new funded RRTC, we also have HIPE focus on those who have an employment as their primary goal. So these are some of the intervention and a little bit of some of the other pieces that sort of got us really thinking hard about how do you support careers. So what do I mean by career? So I realized, what was the, Sally, you put up something that was the World Health Organization's, what is it? Decent work. When you put that up, I was like, wow, we worked really hard to come up with this. They'd already come up with something. But in our first State of the Science meeting, what came out of that was really this recognition that we really need to talk about careers and this infusion of both education, training, the accumulation of skills and knowledge to build capacity for launching more sustaining and sustained work lives. And so we wanted to make it clear, because when we first talked careers, people thought white-collar careers, that's what we mean by careers. We meant, no, any kind of line of work that has sustained periods of employment in one or a series of related positions, that has a progressive development of knowledge, skills, and useful expertise, that has increasing remuneration consistent with growing expertise. So that's what we wanted to really focus our research on. And how do we build interventions that get more of that? And so we did the CHEER study, which is completed, actually helped Catherine complete her dissertation, so she's now on our faculty from just being a young adult. Now she's not a young adult, but she's on our faculty. And just some brief findings from that was that not so different from the general population, post-secondary school and training, that the patterns are non-linear, but in this population, more disrupted. So multiple attempts at post-secondary education, lots of starts and stops, trying different schools and programs. Well, this program didn't work for me here. Maybe I'll try that school. Also talking about lack of a clear goal or motivation for pursuing. Everybody else was doing it, so I figured I'd do it too. And then you hit real problems, and then the motivation isn't there. This one is particularly detrimental. Dropping courses after ad drop period. You get in, you start a class, you think you can make it, and then things happen, and you're not able to complete the class, and you withdraw or you drop out of the class, but now you've accrued debt and you've gotten no progress on your goal of graduating to go to offset that debt. And then on the positive side, a lot of folks were pursuing trainings and certifications, and so some of the jobs they talked about, phlebotomy, hairdressing, cosmetology, personal care assistant, that seemed to be a line that was getting people some success in completing their training. And then in terms of their work patterns, so the things that we talk about, most of the jobs that they had, other than these phlebotomy here, the ones over here, were big box or restaurant-based work. They were mostly short-duration jobs. that they've talked a lot about quitting or just not showing up, kind of giving up, or getting fired was happening with some frequency. That they had big gaps in their periods of being employed. There was a lot of going back between trying to have a job, going to school, maybe getting a little bit more training so you can get a better job. That's not working out. You have to go get a job. Some people were doing it at the same time. And then really limited growth over time, but mostly talking about honing some sense of what they like and don't like about their work. So that gives you a flavor for some of the patterns that were being described by young adults. But you can see it's the school and working, working, schooling, schooling and working, one then the next, and a desire and an effort to have a stronger work life based on better education and training. Then the work that we had done with folks from the IPS shop, we started off with trying to do a general adaptation for transition age youth that we ran at Thresholds. The major things that came out of that was developed and manualized an approach to provide peer coaches. So as far as I know, for youth peer coaches, this was the first manualized approach that was available to the field. The attempt broadened the approach for supported employment that had been developed in some of the interventions for first episode psychosis to this different population. The two populations differ in really important ways, although developmentally they're in very similar places. The approach included helping people pursue their GEDs, returning to high school, helping with applications to college, but it was married to a fairly traditional supported employment approach. The second study we did really said this high school age population trying to help, because we know that one of the factors that predicts success in employment is having had a job during high school, had your first job during high school. And so we should be supporting that. So thinking about how do you help young people get a job if that's their goal, but you also want them to finish high school. So you want to support that employment. But a high school is really different from college in terms of how you provide supports there. So can we figure that out? This was conducted in Maryland where they were already offering IPS to 16-year-olds and older, and whoever's doing the study on local adaptations, they had already started to sort of mess with it, even though they were still trying to reach high-level fidelity with it so they could be reimbursed. So we helped them be exposed to the experiences locally. They developed a manual and conducted an open trial. Peer coaches were not involved. That study is still being completed. So we're hoping that there's been some influence to sort of shift sort of an understanding of the needs of the youngest workers and a group of young people who have a wide array of serious mental health conditions that may look very different from those who have first episode psychosis or who may be have schizophrenia. It's a broader array of conditions that you see in this age group. And then I would say I think I just said all of that. Okay, so I'm going to skip to the work that Michelle has been leading on the HYPE approach, which started 2012 with a development drip. I know it was with a development drip, but I think it was 2012. I'm glad to see she's much younger than I am and she can't remember either. So I think the premise Michelle started with is let's start with a career development model that fully integrates employment and education supports for young adults. And to flesh that out, she and there were co-investigators from our center, which is how we knew about what was going on and have formed a lovely relationship and attracted her to us more recently. Yeah, she says. But they did a scoping review of approaches that support both education and training goals and employment. They did interviews of nominated best practices. So what are people doing? What can we glean from that? She did a real participatory integration of experts' input into what they were learning. So an incredibly impressive involvement of young people with lived experience in an amazing meeting that brought all these experts together to have these very genuine conversations about what works and what doesn't work and what do they think of this and who would do this, who would engage in this kind of a service. There were providers of relevant young adult services researchers. Kim was there. We had Kim there at that meeting. There were all kinds of folks providing their expert input. Crystal was there too, that's right. It's hard to remember back so far.
I peaked, that was my peak.
Oh, okay. And the clear premise after reviewing all of that and really developing what was the model was that what was so important was really putting a conceptual model of around the accrual of human capital is the key to sustained adult work lives.